Holding my chest.
My legs and hands.
Silence.
Feeling the pressure.
What?
She was a fraud.
It's a million bloody degrees out there.
No wind.
I'm sorry if I said anything awful.
Blessed lambs of God.
Why hadn't he got up to chop the capsicums?
I was never a good reader.
Immaculately bland.
Anyway, it looks like...
What do we do with this now?
You're not even supposed to use the word fat.
Boys like girls.
When we were very young...
I was back home in Norwich.
Square Sound. You're listening to the audiobook podcast for the makers and listeners of audiobooks.
Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of the audiobook podcast. I'm Abby Holmes, and together with Justine Sloan-Lees, hi Justine.
Hello.
We discuss what goes on behind the stories in the production of audiobooks.
Some of you may have listened to or read the Rosie series by Graeme Sinsian. It began back in 2013 with the Rosie Project, which was such a big hit that Graeme followed up with the Rosie Effect. And now in 2019, the Rosie Result, which is the last book of the series, is not going to be writing anymore. Now, lots of people, if the ratings on Audible or anything to go by, have listened to and enjoyed the Rosie series, or they may have actually read the book themselves. Now, when the first book came out, the first audiobook was produced and Dan O'Grady was cast as narrator. And it's been a bit of a journey for Dan. He was living in London when the first book came out and he was asked to narrate it there. And then he moved back to Australia where he's from. So Dan's actually worked in three different studios on the book, but the third one came to us here at Square Sound. And so I worked with Dan on the book. Now, because it's such a popular series and Dan has embodied that voice for so many listeners, it was really important to us that there be a consistency across the three books. And so as the director, I listened to the earlier books to make sure that I was familiar with the story, the feel, the characters, and I could help guide Dan back into that world. We also had a lovely time because we invited Graeme Sinsian into the studio and he'd never met Dan before. So it was interesting for Dan and Graeme to chat and meet each other and talk about this man, this wonderful man that so many people love, Don Tillman, and just explore that world.
Thanks, Justine. So let's go to Dan and Graeme in conversation in the Square Sound booth, talking books, autism, and, yeah, where's the movie?
Where did all the inspiration come from for the series, for the story?
Well, they say write what you know, and I went into a writing course, a screenwriting course, as it was originally, with a background in information technology, whereas most people coming from more of an arts background. So yep. I thought, let's write about one of the guys, the sort of guys that I used to hang out with that were my friends and so forth. And there was one particular friend whose story I found pretty inspirational. It was really about him caring for his disabled wife and all this sort of stuff. So it started off as a drama and it went through loads and loads of rewrites and so forth. It became a comedy. The only thing that really survived was the basic personality of Don Tillman.
And so this guy that inspired it had Asperger's or...?
Well, he certainly doesn't identify as right. As being autistic, as yep. we'd say these days.
Yep.
But I think the reading the books has inspired him a little bit to look at that question a little bit more closely. But, you know, he, like me, he grew up in the days where that was a real negative,
yes.
where that would be a put down.
Yep.
Whereas today it's seen more as an identity, as something you can feel proud of,
yep.
you know, out and proud.
Yep.
So he's never identified as being on the spectrum, but he loves the books. And he doesn't see the character as being himself.
He doesn't.
No, actually, it's funny because I said, come on, man. I said, it isn't you, of course, but I said, I did take three stories out of your life. And he said, like what? And I said, well, the apricot ice cream disaster. I said, yeah. You told me that happened. He said, no, I didn't. I said, oh, come on. I named the woman,
yep.
and he said, oh, something like that happened.
Yeah.
But it was peach ice cream. So, you know.
And I remember there was a scene from memory, the first one I really liked was the maitre d' in the Flash restaurant. And, you know, the karate stuff and all of that kicking off.
Yeah, you know, the very first thing I wrote in trying to work up this idea, even though I was going to be writing a screenplay, I had a class assignment, which was to write a short story.
Yep.
And I wrote a short story called The Jacket Incident, which was basically taking this story, which was inspired by something that had happened in New York City with my friend,
yep.
where he'd brought a jacket, but it was a bushwalking jacket, and you know, we couldn't go out to. And we got it all sorted out before we even went out to the steakhouse that required a jacket.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you do as an author is you say, yeah, what if? Yeah. What if we'd actually been at the restaurant? What if it wasn't me, but a date he was trying to impress? What if he had martial arts skills? So you just leverage the whole thing right up, and that little short story sort of survived almost intact into the novel 5 years later.
Brilliant. Okay.
So I'm interested in how you found the book when you started off with the Rosie Project.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned to you before, it's a pleasure for an actor to actually, you know, actors are guns for hire. We rarely say no, probably should say no more often. The book came along. It's such a pleasure to actually work on something that you actually really enjoy with interesting characters, and you can follow the journey. And also being an audiobook, you get to play all these other characters as well. So,
which I always think is the great challenge. People said, would you like, as the author, would you like to read it yourself?
Yeah.
And I thought I could pretty much nail Don Tillman's voice in my head. But what am I going to do when Rosie speaks or Claudia speaks or Dave the American speaks? And that's where I just don't have the acting chops. And you know, I dips me lid to you and being able to do that. And I have to say, I mean, the feedback we've had, this is the first time we've met face to face.
It is.
But the feedback that I've had about your reading is just so enormously positive. And I would say particularly from the Americans,
okay,
who just love Australian accent. I mean, yeah, if you're a single man and you went to America saying, I'm the guy who read The Rosie Project, I think you'd be sent.
You'd be all right. Yeah. I probably, you know, it's a very stop-start process. Even if you make a little flub or something, bang, straight back, start the sentence again. But really, the challenge for me was jumping in and out, particularly in close proximity to each other, from character back to character, you know, American, Indian, Australian, whatever it was.
Yeah, but people want diversity, but you're the one who's got to do the Indian accent.
Yeah, you know, so that's probably the hardest challenge.
What about moving from studio to studio? Because this has been a bit of a roving commission for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it started in London. When I lived in London, they approached me over there, and we're in the Penguin Studio, which is an enormous
building.
There, yeah. And I had a director on that one who was excellent, who was extremely forensic with the work. And it, I don't want to use the word laborious, but it was very stop-start. But it produced a wonderful, I hope, performance at the end. The second one was a little different. It was a slightly more technical, less, I suppose, I was left to my own devices a bit more. And I would probably say, working now with Justine here, it's probably halfway between the two. So it's a nice balance.
Now, I've been told to ask you this question. But I'd probably ask you anyway, which of the three books do you like the best?
I'm liking the third and the first more. Mm. I think something happened to Rosie in the second book. And
yeah, yours is a very common response.
Yeah.
People say, we don't like Rosie.
Yeah, I sort of went off her a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it was quite deliberate in the writing because people had said to me, I had no intention of writing a sequel, but people said to me after the Rosie Project, they said, oh, that's all very well, but the marriage wouldn't last. Nobody could live with someone like Don.
Yep.
And I wanted to show that they could. So I wanted a portrait of the marriage, and I wanted to put in the real stress.
Yes.
And then it was like Nancy Reagan famously said, marriage is never 50-50, it's always 90-10.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been a good story if Rosie was doing the 90 and Don was going along for the ride. We had to see Don step up to the plate.
Yep.
So, okay, Rosie has got to be doing it tough.
Yep.
She's got to be, and we've all been in places in our relationships where we think the other partner is not pulling the weight, but we say we've got to step up. And Rosie's under a lot of stress. She's pregnant. She's fighting it to get a qualification.
Yeah.
Don's best friend, who's her supervisor, who she hates, has moved in to live with them.
That's right.
Don's keeping a secret from her. So most women, most people would probably fray at the edges a little bit under those circumstances.
I just wanted
that to be happening, so Don had to rise to the occasion. But in this third book, I wanted them back, and I thought, okay, let's have them both fighting City Hall, as it were, or the education system.
And Hudson's an interesting little chap as well.
A lot of people said to me, would love to have a prequel. What we really want is Don's childhood. We want to know what he was like as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that would be interesting, but I'd have to set it in the 1980s
when
attitudes to autism are not what they are today. And, well, that would be interesting historically, but it wouldn't tell us very much that might inform the sort of choices and attitudes we have now. So, okay, in effect, Hudson can stand in Don's place. I'd already given birth to him, as it were, in the book, so he was right there ready to go. Did affect in the end my choice as to what gender he was. Because I wanted a little Don, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Hudson can be a little Don, but in the current world. And then Don, in trying to help Hudson, will reflect on his own childhood. So we still get that there, but it's just not the main thrust of the book.
And there's a lot of female characters in your series, and I'm just curious as to any sort of, you know, where have they come from?
All my characters inspired by people I know. It's not just one person. You take someone like Rosie, and you take a little bit of my ex-wife.
Yep.
As has been.
Is she aware of this?
That was not deliberate.
Is she aware of that?
Her second ex-husband approached me and said, "I know where you got that character from." I thought, "Whoa." Unconsciously, there probably is a little bit of her in there, but not enough that she would be recognisable, and nor was that my intention. There's just a few aspects of her character that have gone into there, just as there are aspects of, you know, somebody I was studying with, aspects of my current partner and so on are in there, all mixed up in a pot. You stir it up, you add a big dollop of imagination, but I try to get my inspiration from real life rather than from, say, literature, television, research.
Yep. You corrected me earlier, and it is featured in this book, and I don't remember it in the others, was autism and Asperger's. Mm-hmm. We don't sort of say Asperger's anymore. Or
the game has changed. The world has changed in the autism world enormously since the publication of the Rosie Project, which was only 6 years ago. But the word Asperger's has fallen out of fashion, partly because Hans Asperger, who was named... for whom the syndrome is named, apparently had Nazi connections and so forth, so does that. But there's also the diagnostic manual in the States, DSM-5, has said, look, it's all autism. Now, you could have had a pushback on that. You could have had people, so-called high-functioning or low-needs autism, saying, hang on, we're different. We're the Aspergers, they're the autistics.
We're the lightweight version.
Yeah, it could have gone that way, but it didn't. What it did was there's a sense of community amongst all of those, all the way from the people who don't have speech and can't take any sort of care of themselves to the brilliant scientist who just might have a few social issues. So that's formed a community, and I think social media has really, really helped that community to form and to interact. So I got my sense of that community for the Rosie result from watching Twitter largely, because you get it unfiltered. Yeah. If you read papers and go to conferences, everybody's very careful and prepared and so on. Twitter's where people pile on. You see what causes them to pile on, what makes them angry and so on. And that fed into the book.
Okay, that's interesting.
I mean, when I wrote The Rosie Project, I didn't even identify Don as autistic or having Asperger's. I gave a nod to it.
Yep.
But I said, after the book was published, I was talking to an expert clinician, Professor Tony Atwood, world expert on the subject. And I said, look, I don't know if Don has Asperger's. He's not based on anybody with a diagnosis. He's drawn from people that I knew who were probably called geeks and nerds and so on, but without a diagnosis. And Tony turned to me and said, Graham, I am telling you, Don Tillman has Asperger's syndrome. So he was officially diagnosed at that point.
So he has been diagnosed.
Yeah, and I felt that by the third book, and we touched it again in the second book, but I thought by the third book I had to confront it and really deal with it as it would be dealt in the world today.
Yeah. That's interesting. And it's interesting how both Hudson's teachers and Don's employers all want to put a ring fence around him to enable them to operate with, once he's branded, then it's sort of all okay and we can move on, you know?
Yeah. I don't think anyone realises how offensive some of that branding is until they'd experience it themselves.
Yeah.
A good conversation I had recently was about a kid, an autistic kid who got violent at school. And all of the conversation was about the teachers and how awful it must be for them and how do you manage a class with someone like that in it and so on. And nobody was speaking about what it must be like for this kid, what buttons had been pushed. And I think it's a funny thing that if you say what characterises autism, then the layperson is very likely to say a lack of empathy. Yep. These people don't have empathy. You say, hang on a second, this thing cuts both ways. What about the neurotypicals? What about us?
Yeah.
Are we failing to understand and relate to what their needs are?
Empathise.
Yeah, empathise, just because they're the smaller tribe.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty important part of the book too. But,
yeah.
And I think the Rosie books, there has been an enormous destigmatising of autism, enormous moves, I think, towards empathising, but we're not there yet by a long way. And I like to think that the Rosie books have been a positive part of that movement, because more people will read those than will read, say, an academic paper or even a treatise on it.
It's almost, sometimes you think perhaps it gets misdiagnosed as narcissism sometimes.
Oh, I think it's regularly misdiagnosed, and particularly historically. My wife's a psychiatrist, and they just didn't have any real training in Asperger's slash autism. It just wasn't on the radar for them. And I have Don as being misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, with depression, which he had at one point in his life, with psychosis, schizophrenia.
Yep.
They had a set of labels. And I'm pretty harsh about that in the book and even in the acknowledgements. But historically, someone like Don, and certainly my good friend, really suffered badly because of those sorts of mistakes.
The badging and sort of the branding of people also showed up in the racial incident in the third book, which I found really, really interesting that you danced around that, got very close to the fire on that one. And it's good to see that sometimes, again, in the same way, you know.
Some of my international editors would have said I got too close to the fire in that. But I wanted to put it out there because I think it's a real issue. We have seen these situations where quite often a senior academic or someone has said something misogynist or racist, and they would say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't realise, I didn't get it.
Correct, yeah.
And someone in Don's position who does find getting the social stuff right is perhaps more likely to screw up, and this is an issue. How do we deal with that?
But it's also funny.
Well,
and that's weirdly.
Yeah, you know. It was a pretty important scene in the book, and I was encouraged to drop it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I pushed back very hard on dropping it. And what we see is that Don, very shortly after this happens, I mean, Don thinks he's done nothing wrong. The reader may be rooting for Don. And I thought it's really important that he gets called up on how much pain he might have caused.
Yes.
And the person I'm going to get to do that will be the second strongest person in the book, which is Rosie.
Yeah.
So who do we care about? You know, whose voice will we listen to after Don's? Rosie. And Rosie gives him, in his words, a bollocking.
Yes.
And then he reflects on it and accepts that. Now, I don't think he can do much more than that, than to say he realised he did wrong and he loses his job, of course. So he's punished as well.
Yeah. But at that point, they're desperate to badge him up as a...
As a racist?
No, it was autistic. Oh, it was
autistic, yeah. Well,
which makes it more acceptable.
Yep.
And therefore they can brush it to one side.
And he's then fighting that. Does he want to be labelled for the purposes of getting off a misdemeanour and keeping his job? He's never wanted to be labelled in the past, but now it's to his advantage. Does he want to take it?
Yep.
And he reflects on that and he says, what would it mean to people who identify as autistic that I've done a bad job for the team? As it were, I'm using it to get off.
Yeah.
And, certainly when I was in the States, my American publisher for the second book, for The Rosie Effect, there's a scene at the police station where the cop says, we better get you checked out anyway. I don't think you're a bad guy. We better get you checked out because what if you go and shoot up a school next week? They just said it doesn't fit with comedy. I said, well, comedy can do what it likes.
Yeah, damn right.
I said, the thing here is this is what an autistic person does face. In the US in particular, where a couple of shooting incidents, the kid who's done them, or the adult who's done them, has been labelled as autistic or Asperger's, and the public starts to make that connection in their mind. And you think, okay, how would you feel if you were any other minority group and you were pushed into that, I can't trust my daughter with you or whatever it might be.
Yep.
Well, you name the minority group and there'll be some sort of stereotype around that that we think they're more likely to offend in certain ways. And I just wanted to get that even as early as The Rosie Effect. But with this latest book, it's very much on the page. One of the interesting things when we talk about audiobooks is, I started off with a screenwriting background, and some screenwriters write roles with actors in mind, not necessarily to sell it to that actor, but they can imagine that it's Jennifer Lawrence or Ryan Reynolds or whoever it might be actually speaking that role, and they've got that voice in their head.
Yeah.
I don't have that at all.
Do you not, really?
Okay. I have no sort of clear voice in my head. I might have an accent. I have an accent in my head sometimes because that will affect the words I use on the page. If I'm trying to show that somebody, that English isn't their first language, for example, or if they're an American and they will use certain phrases, then I've sort of got that happening. But it's not a voice that I hear in any real sense in my head. So that said, The Best of Adam Sharp was interesting because I knew straight away when I heard the various actors audition for it which one I wanted, but that was the same person that studios had picked. My wife picked the same person, so he may have just been a good actor. It wasn't so much that he had exactly the right voice. It was he was using, I think it was that he was reading the words as I saw them. It wasn't the intonation so much as the expression he was putting around it.
One of the biggest struggles for me from a performance point of view of doing Don is it's a balance between delivering an engaging performance, and I'm driving the engine, and I'm also speaking in a very monotone, repetitive way, often about very emotional subjects and, you know, so on and so forth. It's making that balance between keeping people engaged, but also being true to the balance of that sort of monotone, for want of a better word.
Do you know what I mean?
It's such a hard thing to do.
I know what you mean, and nor do you want to mock or caricature an autistic voice. In fact, we're doing a video at the moment to promote the Rosie result, and I pushed quite hard to have autistic actors involved in it. And as it turned out, they didn't use autistic actors for the actual visuals, but there's a voiceover. And we're getting an autistic actor, and I hope it works out, so I won't name him at the moment just in case it doesn't, to do the voiceover. And I think that'll be great because it's a short piece for a start. You'll get an authentic autistic voice, which is sometimes a little different from a neurotypical voice. But nobody will be able to accuse anyone of caricaturing it or anything like that. It's authentic.
It's real.
It will be more nuanced for that. But, look, I think you're right. As I said, for me, and, you know, if you would argue about should we have an autistic person do the reading, and there would be increasingly people who say that it should be done that way and that I shouldn't be writing the book if I'm not autistic, the difficulty is the same as I said myself, that you get Don's voice perfect, but then everybody else's voice actually requires serious acting chops. And you've obviously got them, but, and fine, get an autistic person who's got those serious acting chops and can do the other voices. It's hard to find people who can do this. I'm interested in why people read audiobooks, of course. And I've been absolutely stunned by the number of sales that we've had in the audiobook format. And how much interest there is, the advances, all of those sorts of things. And there's obviously people who drive to work and so forth who are doing things that occupy their eyes but not their mind. And I think it's obviously a very great thing. But the one that I particularly like, I've got a friend who's a great fan of the books, and he lost his eyesight, or his eyesight's faded beyond the point we could read a couple of years ago, and he's 104 in April.
Wow!
So a great fan of the books, and I always make sure he gets the first copy that I get my hands on goes straight to him, because he's not buying unripe bananas at this stage of his life, and it's the same thing. So he's living in Los Angeles, 104 in April. Sam Sachs, his name is. It's just great, and he's completely on the ball about enjoying the books and so forth. So it's great that someone like that can participate in this, where the written book might not be accessible to him.
I think there's a lot of that, and I think also just digitalization now, you're not having to carry around a big box of tapes and change them over and do all that stuff. It's just bang, it's on your phone and you can listen to it. And I think it's reaching a lot more men than women as well. That's the male side of it, of the audience is growing.
It's great, because it's hard to get men to read fiction. And I think the Rosie books have been a real entry point for a lot of guys who stopped reading fiction, often as kids or as teenagers, to come back to it, which has been great.
You're probably not allowed to tell me, but when's the film?
When Sony decide to make it.
Okay.
Look, it's been with Sony for quite some time. They actually own the rights outright. But look, the challenge that they face is they want an A-list actor to play Don, an A-list actor to play Rosie.
Yep.
The chemistry has to be there. The time has to be there. They've got to want to play each other and so forth. And the stars just haven't aligned.
Yeah, right. And would you think they'd set it in America or?
Oh, yeah.
It would
be an international movie set in the US with US actors. So Don would not have your charming Australian accent. It seems very, very unlikely. Even if he was an Australian actor, I think he'd be doing the international film accent.
I fancied myself as Gene there for a while.
Oh. Yeah. Which character do you like most or least, or gives you the most pain?
Gives me the most pain. I obviously love Don. He's extremely frustrating. For somebody that has such a linear approach, it seems to send him off on a spiral of events. As I said, I fell slightly out of love with Rosie in the effect. But Gene just makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Gene's just great.
He's a divisive character. I think for the movie, they didn't want him to be actually cheating on his wife. They wanted them to be separated.
Separate, so, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been really good talking to you. Thank you.
Look, really enjoyed meeting you and talking to you. And, you know, it's a 4.5 star rating out there. You can't do any better than that, because eventually the book is going to let you down. So.
Yeah, nonsense.
you're constrained by the material you have to work with.
But it's been a pleasure to read.
Okay, well, thanks very much for doing this. I'm just so pleased to have you back for the third book.
It's nice to cap it all off.
You've been listening to the audiobook podcast brought to you by Square Sound. If there's something that we haven't covered in our audiobook series that you'd like to know about, send us a message at studio.squaresound.com.au. The audiobook podcast was produced by Marianne Plaza, together with Abby Holmes and Justine Sloan-Lees. With special thanks to all our guest speakers, Square Sound is an audiobook and podcast studio in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks for listening.